Visual art propels the American movement. In the first decade of the 20th century, invigorated by the vitality of the UK suffrage movement, the US Women's Right to Vote campaign assumed an even more visible presence in American culture. Via mass-market prints such as cartoons and illustrations, as well as the high arts formats of painting and sculpture, suffragists used art to persuasively make the case for the equality of women. Many artists, of course, also used these outlets to argue against women's suffrage. Magazine and newspaper illustrations, some of the first avenues for suffrage-related visual art, were now widespread at the start of the 20th century. Whereas previously an image may have only been published in a magazine or newspaper, now it might appear in different forms, including posters or the novel medium of postcards. Images were also now being simultaneously printed in multiple different formats. Many of the illustrations made in the first decades of the 20th century were clearly influenced by suffrage arts in the UK. Specifically, several surviving examples show that American artists borrowed the theme of contrasting lesser kinds of people who were denied the vote with its dignified heroines. The postcard "Paupers, Lunatics, Criminals, and Idiots," figure 32, made for the Women's Suffrage Party of New York, is very similar to Emily J. Harding's "Convicts, Lunatics, and Women," made just a few years earlier for the ASL in the UK. Instead of a cage, however, here a woman stands close to the disenfranchised, looking toward a building resembling the U.S. Capitol. The words, "We pray you to remove your women constituents from the disenfranchised class of paupers, lunatics, criminals, and idiots," emphasize the postcard's message. Linked Together by the Law, figure 33, by Mae Wilson Preston, shows a dignified young woman and a small child chained to two men, presumably a convict and a lunatic. The dignity of the women and child are, of course, contrasted with the indignity of their companions. A broadside, figure 34, published by the Women's Political Union, took the same approach in its attempt to call attention to the injustice of New York voting laws. The text beneath the image addresses the injustice of allowing former convicts to vote while denying that right to women. The image shows two different types of women: an educated woman in a cap and gown, and an idealized mother with a baby. Both women are being physically held back from voting by a police officer proclaiming, "Stand back, ladies," in order to allow a line of men wearing striped prison uniforms to drop their votes in the ballot box. Another broadside, "The Trumpeter Awaking New York," figure 35, produced by the Women's Political Union for New York City, borrows directly from Caroline Watts' Bugler Girl, see figure 31, and depicts a female bugler in a distinctly American context. Bearing a flag with five stars, representing the five states where women enjoyed suffrage at the time, she is trumpeting the battle call to New York women. The caption under the image reads, "The trumpeter realizing all the achievements of the women of the past, bearing a banner which in the number of the stars emblazoned on it suggests the five states in which women have won political freedom, calls in bugle notes upon the women of New York to march on May 6th in solemn protest against their continued disfranchisement." This was but one of many instances of Watts' Bugler Girl being adopted and serving as shorthand for women's suffrage. While these new cartoons borrowed messaging from their UK sisters, the earlier tradition of the newspaper-style political cartoon also persisted and flourished. Such images were less focused on big ideas and were more concerned with making acute political critiques. One striking example, an illustration, figure 36, by Pulitzer Prize-winning cartoonist Clifford K. Berryman, critiques the common political usage of the term "the people." The image shows President Roosevelt declaring, "Let the people rule." A group of men carry a sign reading, "We're the people," while the sign hoisted by a group of animals reads, "We're the animals." A group of women, excluded from either category, carry a sign reading, "We're what?" A pair of similar cartoons, figure 37, survives from an NAWSA scrapbook collection. In Woman's Sphere, a woman peers over a fence in a walled-up space marked Woman's Sphere, neglecting her toys, a doll labeled Fashion, and a top labeled Gossip. The cartoon's caption reads, "Woman devotes her time to gossip and clothes because she has nothing else to talk about. Give her broader interests and she will cease to be vain and frivolous." Although the image supports the broadening of the concept of the woman's sphere, it is damning in its perception of contemporary woman. The other image is less pointed. It shows a fashionable young woman pushing a baby carriage as she casts her vote. Still another set of surviving clippings, figure 38, from the NAWSA suffrage scrapbook, shows the more journalistic side of newspaper cartoons. Prominent suffrage leaders are depicted alongside laudatory text about the suffrage movement, and another clipping shows a women's suffrage meeting in New York City. Naturally, there continued to be naysayers, and they contributed to the flourishing visual discourse with their own illustrations. Such anti-suffrage imagery was especially widespread in the form of postcards. By the turn of the century, postcards were quite a popular new print medium. People collected them and displayed them in their homes. Illustrations and cartoons initially published elsewhere often subsequently appeared on these fashionable new cards, but many images were also specifically produced with this format in mind. Commercial companies often created postcards in series, and one of the most popular sets of anti-suffrage postcards was produced by Dunstan Weiler Lithograph Company in 1909. The Suffragette series, as it was called, consisted of 12 postcards, all relying on the subversion of gender roles, a trope wielded by anti-suffragettes since the movement's early days. Some of the most notable examples are "I Want to Vote, But My Wife Won't Let Me," figure 39, "Election Day," figure 40, "Uncle Sam, Suffragee," figure 41, "Suffragette Madonna," figure 42, and "Suffragette Vote Getting," figure 43. Cards like these, issued in sets, were the most popular, and as they were publicly circulated, clearly played a prominent role in the women's suffrage debate. Indeed, as one scholar points out, the popularity of postcards in the early 20th century rivals the power of the internet in contemporary times. Although the anti-suffragists were prolific producers of postcards, so were those in favor of suffrage. Women's suffrage groups first began using postcards as an easy way to spread textual information, especially regarding organization meetings. These cards, however, were purely text-based and did not include graphic art. Another type of pro-suffrage postcard, quite popular, especially for its use of new, exciting technology, was the photo card. Photo cards were often event-specific, created to commemorate an event such as a meeting or march. Suffragists also created message cards, postcards with visual images and propagandistic messaging. Suffrage historian Kenneth Florey calls these an extremely effective form of advertising and persuasion to the general public. Florey also points out that these pro-suffrage cards were widely available, advertised in publications, sold in person and via mail order, and distributed at rallies. NAWSA was one of the leading producers of message cards, and their messaging was concise and effective, as "The Blot on the Escutcheon," figure 44, shows. In this postcard, there is quite literally a blot on the American federal shield, that blot being the fact that the ballot is denied to woman. Suffrage debates acted out by cute boys and girls was another popular postcard theme. "Votes for Women," figure 45, is an excellent example of this type, which was especially favored because it made the suffrage debates seem harmless. Many postcards also used babies to request the vote for their mothers, appealing to the idea that a mother should undeniably have legal input into how her child is fed, schooled, and raised. A perfect example of this category is Give Mother the Vote, Figure 46, which shows a group of babies marching with a flag reading, Votes for Our Mothers. They further explain their request in the text below them. Our food, our health, our play, our homes, our school, our work are ruled by men's votes. Isn't it a funny thing that father cannot see why mother ought to have a vote on how these things should be? Think it over. Postcards were one of the most prominent and beloved modes of pro-suffrage messaging, but these sorts of images were also featured in other kinds of mass-market products, from buttons and badges to paper napkins. The calendar was one of the first such kinds of suffrage ephemera. The Collegiate Equal Suffrage League of New York State sold one containing 450 pertinent quotations in 1910, Figure 47. It uses the simple visual devices of scales and classical architectural columns to allude to the American legal system, as well as to the abstract concept of justice, supplemented by the text, "Taxation without representation is tyranny." Set within this imagery, the names of the states Idaho, Wyoming, Utah, and Colorado surround the central image, a reminder of the fact that women could vote in those four states, and an appeal to bring such justice to the rest of the country. Suffrage imagery also began to appear on the suffrage stamp, which borrowed from the 19th century tradition of using political stamps in support of a political candidate. An early example, Figure 48, archived in the Miller NAWSA suffrage scrapbooks at the Library of Congress, shows a woman wearing a cap and gown standing next to a placard that reads, "In Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, and Idaho, women vote on equal terms with men." The clipping accompanying this stamp in the Library of Congress provides an explanation for how it could be used. "These stamps will be placed on the lower left-hand corner of letters sent by those who believe in political equality." To elevate the cause of women's suffrage, more and more trained artists were producing works that could be used as part of the mass-market print culture of posters, postcards, and pamphlets, as well as artworks on their own. One early example is the 1905 oil painting Woman's Suffrage by Evelyn Rumsey Carey, Figure 49. Carey was a native of Buffalo, New York. Although little is known of her early artistic career, she established a modest name for herself as a painter. She rose to fame overnight in 1901 when she painted The Spirit of Niagara, depicting Niagara Falls in the form of a woman. Carey's painting became the official emblem of the Pan American Exposition in 1901, and more than 100,000 copies of her image were printed and distributed around the country in anticipation of this spectacular World's Fair. Having used the female form as allegory to masterful effect in that painting, Carey later used this skill in Woman's Suffrage, featuring a female figure whose flowing dress and laurel crown reference classical antiquity. Morphing into a tree, she sprouts branches from her fingertips and roots at her feet. Carey thus lends the figure authority by associating her with classical values and virtues, while also making her into an iconic Mother Nature figure. Placing her in front of a classical building suggested the importance of women's involvement in the country's most important institutions. Carey also references the story of Daphne and Apollo from Ovid's Metamorphoses, an archetypal subject in art history. The story of the Greek goddess being turned into a tree as a means of evading the unwanted romantic pursuit of the god Apollo has obvious feminist undertones. That Carey references this story in the context of a painting about women's suffrage seems significant. Further strengthening the message of this already powerful image is the biblical quotation from Proverbs chapter 31, verse 31. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. Carey's painting was reproduced in posters, pamphlets, magazine covers, and other formats. For example, a copy of the painting graced the back cover of The Woman Citizen in 1918. Carey's tremendously popular image became an important icon for the American suffrage movement. Bertha Margaret Boyer of Oakland, California, created another iconic work of art with her Votes for Women poster, Figure 50, in 1911. Her image was selected as the winner for a 1911 poster contest hosted by the San Francisco College Equal Suffrage League in support of suffrage rights in California. Boyer's image is at once bold and subtle. She depicts a woman standing in front of San Francisco's bay and hills. The sun creates a halo around her head, and gently sloping hills rise up on either side of her shoulders, creating the appearance of a religious icon. Boyer's treatment of the woman's body is such that most of it appears flattened and transparent, blending in with the water in the foreground of this scenic, striking landscape. At her head and shoulders, however, she takes on greater three-dimensionality, seeming to meld into the robust California hillside. The neckline of her dress perfectly matches up with the shoreline at the base of the hills on either side of her, creating the illusion of a bridge between them. As with Carey's image, this figure is physically rooted to the land in which she is depicted. The image was displayed in storefronts all over San Francisco in the week leading up to the vote, which was ultimately successful, giving California women suffrage in 1911. The image was reproduced and used by suffrage campaigns across the country until federal suffrage was won 9 years later. The artist Cornelia Cassidy Davis produced an extremely popular poster, Figure 51, for the Ohio Votes for Women campaign in 1912, using imagery and techniques similar to those used by Boyer in her successful California poster. Cassidy Davis's woman stands in front of a group of hills, her shoulders and head blending into the landscape. Like Boyer's woman, this woman's head is also framed by the sun, creating a halo effect. At either side of her are sheaves of wheat, symbolic of the earth's abundance. Like most successful posters, this image was printed on many different kinds of suffrage items, including postcards. The use of a woman within an allegorical context became a recurring theme in much of the pro-suffrage imagery of the early 20th century. Indeed, it became something of a shorthand for the twin ideals of justice and virtue as associated with the suffrage cause. This kind of imagery appeared throughout the movement, from the work of woman cartoonists to posters to campaign flyers and pamphlets. Theatrical work and its advertising were also conduits for the cause. Actors not only performed in feminist-minded plays, but also wrote and performed in suffrage shows written and inspired by movement members and supporters. A poster advertising a matinee performance of Suffrage Plays at the Broad Street Theater in Philadelphia, Figure 52, is also a beautiful work of art in the tradition of artists like Carey, Boyer, and Cassidy Davis, featuring a woman in classical garb standing atop the earth in front of Philadelphia's famed Liberty Bell, a clear reference to the liberty sought by suffragists. As the graphic arts had begun to blossom in the early 20th century, even advertisements like this were carefully crafted and borrowed themes from the history of art to inspire its audience. Even the field of sculpture entered into the conversation about women's suffrage. The sculptor Ella Buchanan's contribution had a wide reach in the movement. She sculpted The Suffragist Arousing Her Sisters, Figure 53, in 1911. As with so much of the art being produced for the suffrage movement in this era, her work borrows from allegorical tropes used over centuries of art history to connect the cause of women's suffrage to some of the great and just causes of human history. The woman in the center of the group is the suffragist, blowing her metaphoric horn to awaken her sisters. The downtrodden figures around her represent the concepts of degradation, vanity, conventionality, and the wage earner, all of whom rely on the suffragist to lift them up. Buchanan's sculpture also references Caroline Watts' famous Bugler Girl, which originated in the UK and became something of a suffrage icon in the US. Buchanan's work actively circulated in the form of suffrage merchandise, from photographs that were printed on postcards to cast statuette replicas. The first decades of the 20th century were also notable for the rise of the woman cartoonist. A number of trained women artists, who were also suffragists, were recognized for their talents and published in newspapers and magazines around the country. Most importantly, these cartoons were not one-offs. Many artists were valued enough that they were retained as regular contributors, enabling them the latitude to develop a distinct creative style and messaging aesthetic. Lou Rogers was one of the most notable of these early woman cartoonists, and one of the very first American women to make a career as a cartoonist. She was also a suffragist who was actively involved in the National Woman Suffrage Association. She regularly contributed to the Woman's Journal, among other publications, and was eventually hired as the main cartoonist for Judge Magazine's Modern Woman section. It is easy to see why Rogers enjoyed such a successful career. Her images are not only appealing, but they also are suffused with a sense of empowerment. The women in her cartoons in Judge Magazine all take decisive action to correct whatever wrong they are being faced with, literally breaking free from shackles, disciplining bad politicians, vacuuming away old-fashioned ideas, and engaging in other empowering activities. See figures 54 through 57. Rogers also created satirical images, like her Dispossessed, figure 58, in which a hen appears at a government demonstration on how to run a nest without waste and finds a rooster there. In an article in Cartoons magazine in 1913 that featured this young cartoonist who was destined to win battles for the women's movement, Rogers quite tellingly said, "Better than almost any other medium, the picture can make a woman see the truth about the conditions into which her daughter and her neighbor's daughter go, and into which, through changes of circumstances, she herself may be forced to go." Rogers was but one of many cartoonists who rose to fame in the 20th century. Blanche Ames Ames, like Rogers, was a trained artist and passionate suffragist whose cartoons were published in suffrage magazines. Ames would become an art editor for the Woman's Journal in 1915. Unsurprisingly, her cartoons are incisive and often stinging, as in Meanwhile They Drown, figure 59. Cartoons like Double the Power of the Home, figure 60, however, show Ames's range. When necessary, she could make her point in sentimental images that were less pointed. A number of women joined the ranks of professional cartoonists in the 1910s, and their work contributed to changing perceptions of women and women's suffrage, helping change public opinion in myriad, far-reaching, and subtle ways.